over northeast Scotland, highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. Finally on to southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, where it will be a dull and damp day with a brisk wind. The rain will continue on and off through most of the day, and temperatures will struggle to reach 6 to maybe 8 Celsius. That's the forecast.
All right, Alex, thank you very much. Now, Radio 4, our Book of the Week, and Peter Firth continues to read from James Wood's collection of essays, The Fun Stuff. Today he considers the brilliance of Kazuo Ishiguro in his book, Never Let Me Go.
Works of fantasy of science fiction that also succeed in literary terms are hard to find and are rightly to be treasured. Hawthorne's story, The Birthmark, comes to mind, and H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. And just as one is triumphantly sizing up this thin elite, one thinks of that great fantasist Kafka, or even of Beckett, two writers whose impress can be felt perhaps surprisingly on Kazuo Ishiguro's novel Never Let Me Go. A genre that must make room for Kafka and Beckett and Dostoevsky is perhaps no longer a genre, but merely a definition of writing successfully. In particular, a way of combining the fantastic and the realistic so that we can no longer separate them, and of making allegory earn its keep by becoming indistinguishable from narration itself. Never Let Me Go is a fantasy so mundanely told, so ordinary in transit, its fantastic elements so smothered in the loam of the banal and so deliberately grounded, that the effect is not just of fantasy made credible or lifelike, but of the real invading fantasy, bursting into its eccentricity and claiming it as normal. Given that Ishiguro's novel is explicitly about cloning, that it is, in effect, a science fiction set in the present day, and that the odds against success in this mode are bullyingly stacked, his success in writing the book is almost miraculous. Never Let Me Go begins, "My name is Kathy H. I'm 31 years old, and I've been a carer now for 11 years." It maintains this tone of pristine ingenuity for almost 300 pages. Kathy's story is about a private boarding school she attended called Hailsham in the English countryside, and in particular about two close friends, Ruth and Tommy. It becomes clear enough that although the novel is set in the late 1990s, it inhabits a world somewhat adjacent to the one we know. Kathy refers to donors, whom carers look after. The school she is reminiscing about does not seem to have had teachers but guardians, who are referred to by their pupils as normals. But the children are not normal. The girls, for instance, will never be able to have babies, and all the pupils appear to be destined not to join ordinary life when they graduate, but to become donors, and to lead abbreviated, highly controlled adult lives. The question of who these children are, and what their function is in modern society, is never very deeply withheld. By the 100th page or so, we realise that Hailsham is a school of cloned children, created in order to provide top-notch organs for donation to normal, uncloned British citizens. At the age of 16, the children will leave Hailsham, spend some time in an intermediate establishment, and then get called up. All will first be chosen to be carers, like Kathy, their task being to look after an assigned donor. Some, like Ruth and Tommy, will be swiftly requested for donation. Perhaps a kidney or a lung will be removed. In the course of their fourth donation, they will complete. They will die. Ishiguro rations the pace at which we receive this terrible information, but his real interest is not in what we discover, but in what his characters discover and how it will affect them. He wants us to inhabit their ignorance, not ours. The children at Hailsham live in a protected environment. They know that they are different, but their guardians are cryptic about this difference. Gradually, through tiny leaks on the part of these guardians, the children gather a burgeoningly complete picture of their fate. So what might it mean to learn as a child that one will never bear children or hold a meaningful job or sail into adulthood. Much of the success of the book has to do with the way Ishiguro renders the normality of the world of Hailsham and then inserts into it icy slivers of menace. Hailsham is like any other school, and if the children feel different, then they are merely like the privileged students of any happy, self-regarding private establishment. The first third of the book chronicles the squabbles and jockeying and jealousies of ordinary schoolchildren. Kathy is clearly in love with Tommy, who seems to be a troubled boy, but Tommy chooses Ruth, who is dismayingly mercurial in her feelings towards Kathy, supposedly her closest friend. There is much rivalrous power play of a kind familiar from books and films about school days between Ruth and Kathy. Kathy's pale narration represents a calculated risk on Ishiguro's part, since it means that his novel is written in what Nabokov once called weak blonde prose. Kathy's diction is relaxed into colloquialism and cliché. A teacher loses her marbles. A rainy day is bucketing down. Students who are having sex are doing it. She is fond of the supremely English word daft and uses woolly intensifiers. At Hailsham, the guardians were really strict about smoking. Ishiguro has always enjoyed ventriloquizing drab English voices, the upholstered butler in The Remains of the Day, the narrator of When We Were Orphans, whose fiddly precise English resembles a parody of Anthony Pohl. Kathy's voice is like an expository writing paper by a not very bright freshman. So bland is it that the reader has a kind of amazed admiration for Ishiguro's freakish courage. One imagines him coming downstairs from a day of writing and triumphantly exclaiming to his wife, "I've done it! I've nailed the scene about the lost geometry set. Tomorrow, I'll write up the class quiz scene." Kathy is somewhat anxiously ingratiating, and her habit of addressing the reader as if the reader were the same as her, saying, for example, "I don't know how it was where you were, but at Hailsham," has a fragile pathos to it. She wants to be one of us, and in some way assumes she is. The very dullness of these children, their lack of rebelliousness, is what grounds the book's fantasy. They never seem to want to run away from the school, to throw over the commanded lives they must eventually lead. Comprehension of who they are makes them sad, but only resignedly so. This is the only reality they have ever known. Ishiguro shakes this banality every so often as the terribleness of what has been done emerges. In an episode which lends the book its title, Kathy remembers becoming obsessed with a song called Never Let Me Go. She would play this song again and again. "I just waited for that bit that went, baby, baby, never let me go. And what I'd imagined was a woman who'd been told she couldn't have babies, who really, really wanted them all her life. Then there's a sort of miracle, and she has a baby, and she holds this baby very close to her and walks around singing, baby, never let me go, partly because she's so happy, but also because she's afraid the baby will get ill or be taken away from her. Even at the time, I realized this couldn't be right, that this interpretation didn't fit with the rest of the lyrics, but that wasn't an issue with me. One day, Kathy is dancing by herself, holding a pillow in her arms and crooning along to the song. She looks up, and in the doorway, Madame, one of the guardians, is watching her, sobbing and sobbing. Kathy, Tommy and Ruth eventually leave Hailsham and are billeted at a place called The Cottages in Norfolk. On an outing to Cromer, friends of the trio are sure that they have seen what they call a possible for Ruth. Since each of us was copied at some point from a normal person, there must be, for each of us, someone out there getting on with his or her life. This meant, at least in theory, you'd be able to find the person you were modeled from. The friends follow the woman they consider Ruth's original, but the longer they watch her, the less like Ruth she seems. The excitement fizzles. Only then does it become apparent that Ruth is terribly disappointed. She bursts out bitterly, "They don't ever, ever use people like that woman. We all know it. We're modelled from trash. junkies, prostitutes, winos, convicts maybe, just so long as they aren't psychos. That's what we come from. A woman like that? Come on. If you want to look for possibles, then you look in the gutter. Look down the toilet. That's where we all come from. The entire episode testifies to what is strangely successful in this book, the way it rubs its science fictional narrative from the rib of the real, making it breathe with horrid plausibility, and then the way it converts that science fiction back into the human, managing to be at once sinister and affecting. The novel is weakened by a didactic ending in which the spirit of H.G. Wells bests the spirit of Borges. Kathy and Tommy are a couple, and he is now just one operation away from death. They manage to track down two former guardians, Miss Emily and Madame, and these now aged ladies apologize to the clone duo for what they have done to them, claiming that they always had the best interests of the children at heart. Madame admits to Kathy that when she saw, all those years ago, the little girl crooning to the song, she cried because she saw a new world coming rapidly, more scientific, efficient, yes, more cures for the old sicknesses, very good, but a harsh, cruel world. And I saw a little girl, her eyes tightly closed, holding to her breast the old, kind world, pleading never to let her go. The novel hardly needs this preaching, partly because it has already so effectively dramatized the horror of what has been brought about, and partly because, of course, the cloning of human beings hardly needs denunciation. The book wobbles into treaties here. It is most powerful when most allegorical, and its power has to do with its picture of ordinary human life as a fact in a culture of death. That is to say, Ishiguro's book is at its best when, by asking us to consider the futility of cloned lives, it forces us to consider the futility of our own. We begin the novel horrified by the children's difference from us and end it thoughtful about their similarity to us. After all, heredity writes a great deal of our destiny for us, and death soon enough makes us orphans, even if we were fortunate enough, unlike the children of Hailsham, not to start life in such deprivation. To be assured of death at 25 or so, as the children are, seems to rob life of all its savour and purpose. But why do we persist in the idea that to be assured of death at 70 or 80 or 90 returns to life all its savour and purpose? Why is sheer longevity accorded meaning, while sheer brevity is thought to lack it? Here it becomes reminiscent of Kafka and Beckett, whose Ham in Endgame yells, "Use your head, can't you? Use your head! You're on Earth! There's no cure for that!" An Earth that Tess, in Hardy's novel, calls a blighted star, and which Hardy again calls blighted in his poem, When Dead. This fleeting life brief blight will have gone past when I resume my old and right place in the vast. So this curious, surprisingly suggestive and tender novel forces us, finally, to send Kathy's apparently naive appeal back to her in a spirit of horrified allegiance. "I don't know how it was where you were, but here in this fleeting life." At its best, the book is seamlessly allegorical, generating meaning without strain.
And tomorrow, James Wood considers the work of the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson. The Fun Stuff is read by Peter Firth, abridged by Eileen Horn, and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Wednesday, the 5th of March. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Biscay, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, 500 miles west of Rockall, 983, expected 100 miles north of southeast Iceland, 963, by 1800 Wednesday. New high, expected white, 1025, by the same time. Lows, Seoul, 999, and Fair Isle, 992, both losing their identities. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira. Southerly or southeasterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 in north,